This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. You see, man made the car to take us over the road. Man make the trains to carry the heavy load. Man makes the electric lights to take us out of the dark. Man made the boat for the water, like Noah made the ark. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connection's first live stream.
Now we're on.
It is great to be here with you tonight. I hope that this first broadcast goes smoothly. We have a lot of questions about the way we are streaming here. This is technical, and we're going to do our best to make this a good program for you. I have a returning guest, of course, to help color the information correctly. His name is Mohammed Rafik. He has been on more than several times, but he's been on several subjects with us, trying to get this information sussed out so that all of us can have a better understanding of just how bad the financial parts of this conspiracy are and what is in our future. And actually, to try and discuss a few of the solutions that might come across. One of them that I discussed today with Mohammed before this programming was, why don't we just have a do-over, get rid of all the debt, just a moratorium on it, and put these criminals out of business just by decree. You're out. You're gone. You're finished. And it seems that's what Vladimir Putin has done with some of his declarations. And so we're going to talk to Mohammed about that, and we're going to welcome him to the first broadcast, live stream broadcast of the French Connection. Mohammed, are you with me?
I certainly am, Darryl. Good evening to you.
Well, it's great to have you here with me. You know, what we're going to try to do here, I'm going to give everybody a little heads up on this new stream. We're going to try a couple of networks here, Mohammed, and I want your input on this because we're going to try to stream a separate stream on Benjamin Friedman. Of course, we're going to use Myron Fagan's work and also the work from the audio file of Representative Finley when he talked about They Dare to Speak Out about his book and some other audio files that are very germane to this subject that we've discussed so many times. And we're also going to put on a separate stream, a separate live broadcast, also a repeat broadcast, of our work with the French Connection, our interviews, financial interviews, some from our history, some of our old files and whatnot. So what do you think of that one?
Well, I find it very exciting, Darryl, that the French Connection is moving into this other technical area and technological area. And that we're getting off to a fairly good start, all things considered, the way that it's such a small team that's working there to get it all working. But I'm finding it very exciting that you're going to be able to reach out to a wider audience now.
Well, you know, one of the problems with doing this by myself and then asking other people to support me, such as Krister has done and you have, of course, done, is that many people, like yourself, you have other responsibilities. Krister has other responsibilities, and this is just a labor of love. We care about what we're doing. We care about the people that are going to be most affected by this, and that's the rank-and-file plebiscite, you and I, basically. And we all deserve a heads-up on what's coming. So let's get right into some of the subjects here. This subprime thing, as I discussed with you today, is not just happening in the housing market either, is it? This is happening in all types of loans that were being given out without moral hazard being considered. A lot of automobile loans The guy I read today said all you needed to have is a temperature over 70 degrees Fahrenheit to get an auto loan. In other words, they were giving out auto loans to people who probably were never going to pay back the money. And he said it's not just a few loans like that. It's in the tens and hundreds of billions. So we're looking at subprime kind of loans of all types out there, Mohammed, and they're all going to go belly up. What do you think about this?
Well, there are clearly many different types of credit. These type of retail loans are one end of the spectrum. There are all sorts of store cards and very high-end credit cards also which are failing. There's a huge amount of debt out there, or credit, depending on which side of the fence you're standing on, as you were discussing credits and debits the other day, and then getting reversed from one part of the world to the other. All of this advanced credit is failing big time. And when you think that the subprime mortgages, a lot of mortgages, you know, Daryl, when the house prices inflate and the people in the papers and the banks and all the pundits encourage people, hey, you've got all this equity available in your property, why don't you go out and remortgage up and take the cash and buy cars for cash and everything like that? So a lot of those mortgages out there, which have been increased, actually are secured car loans. I would even put it to you like that, Daryl, that some of this stuff was actually secured car loans. People use their house to obtain secured credit at a lower rate and bought cars with it. And, of course, the motor industry saw all of these people turning up with cash, and so that meant that their credit facilities were still available. And that normally these people would have taken car credit from the car loan firms. And these car loan firms were desperate to lend to people because their regular business were able to buy with cash. So, yeah, they would lend to anybody with a pulse.
Mohammed, let's talk about how the banks get to package these and then ship them out into the credit markets. Now, we've talked about many of the credit instruments being packaged up into these derivative instruments, into these prime loan instruments, and then sold forward. In other words, somebody actually in Germany or in Switzerland could own the rights to your mortgage in Idaho. Basically, your bank, what it would do is take that loan and sell it out into the marketplace. Now, it's the same thing with automobile loans. How do these things get structured and then shipped out to be sold internationally?
Well, we come back to a subject, a difficult subject for a lot of people who are not in the industry. It's rather like trying to give advice on heart surgery to the man in the street. It is a specialization of all this stuff, but it brings us back to our evil friend, the New Capital Accord. And in the New Capital Accord, one of the things that it gave permission legally for banks to do was something known as securitization. Mm-hmm. And securitization basically was the idea that a bank could have a book with a load of loans in it. People out there have borrowed money from the bank. And what we do is we turn around and we come up with this idea of weighted averages. So we would take the average amount that has been borrowed. We'd calculate an average maturity for it all and an average weight using concepts which I think you might be familiar with. Many people aren't, but concepts like duration of a bond, we can apply the same concept to loans as well. It's just a set of numbers with a repayment schedule, and it all comes through this weighted average number. And what we end up with is an average maturity for all of the loans. We can look at each loan individually, or by the time we've calculated these weighted figures, Daryl, we've got a weighted amount of nominal that's been lent, a weighted amount of loan, an average amount of loan, an average rate, and an average maturity. And that figure is basically the sum total of all the loans in the book. And what we do now is I can then take that sum total figure and sell that on as an asset on the basis that all the other loans in this securitized package give the same effect as if I'd had this single loan here.
Now, let me ask you this. A judge in the United States recently, in Illinois, in fact, said that this bank brought these people to court, 13 families, for foreclosure on their mortgage. And when they arrived in court, a couple of the families said, wait a minute, show me that you're the title holder. And the bank could not produce the title. In other words, the title to the property had been sold on in one of these packages, and they didn't know where it was. But they were acting as the intermediary for the foreclosure action, but they could not produce the title. So the judge said, wait a minute, if you're owner of record and you're the title holder, and so the bank said, no, we're not, Your Honor. We sold on the responsibility of holding that asset elsewhere in the marketplace, and probably it's held by Deutsche Bank. Now, how can a legal system in Germany be putting its pressure on an American foreclosure? In other words, what we've done is just given up our rights as Americans to an international court structure, if that was allowed to happen. But, of course, you and I both know they're not up to that speed yet. The courts in Germany can't force a payment in America.
Well, the strange thing is that when we look at all these different types of loans, we could have the bank that you just mentioned, the German bank that you just mentioned there, could have has a branch in London, of course, and that branch could have a lot of dollar loans. It could have some mortgages in there. It could have some car loans in there. It could have some loans for planes, private boats, mortgage boats, and mortgages for boats and everything like that. And those are all its dollar mortgages and what it do, or dollar debts. And it pulls its dollar debts together, and then it calculates this average amount with an average maturity and average rate, which was, if all these were a single loan, this is what they'd be. And they can sell them on to a third party. I would imagine, actually, that maybe you would be more likely to find J.P. Morgan has probably done that type of securitization of dollar assets and sold it to Deutsche Bank. And what Deutsche Bank have got is a piece of paper that says that they own all this pool of assets. But actually, they own the pool of assets and not the individual assets themselves.
Because who owns the individual assets then?
Well, they're still technically owned by J.P. Morgan or whoever's done the issue. But if we say J.P. Morgan in this instance, that they'd done an issue onto Deutsche, they'd securitized a package to Deutsche. Deutsche owned the package. But actually, when they look at the small print, when they need to enforce it, they need to go back to J.P. Morgan to get the individual details of the package, because they're not interested in how it was made up. All that Deutsche Bank said when they bought the package was, does this look like a sexy loan, this maturity, this rate, and this amount of money? Yeah, okay, we'll take on that responsibility of that. And they don't want to know about the details. How those details are calculated, the securitization process, was done by, say, J.P. Morgan in that instance.
What the judge said is that those families can't be foreclosed on because no one on the bank side of things could produce a title, so they couldn't prove that they had a right to foreclose on anybody. And he said that the people living in those houses have as much right to that property at present time as the people claiming to own it without proof. So he said, case dismissed.
That's right, because Deutsche Bank technically didn't lend the money for the mortgage, and because it's part of a securitized package, their actual asset, the house, could theoretically be being used by J.P. Morgan as collateral on another package, because the J.P. Morgan are allowed to split, they're allowed to strip the asset from the loan element. And what they do is they'll take the loan repayments that they're getting from the people who are paying the mortgage and only sell that element on. And in the meantime, they've got the collateral element, the security there, and they can sell that to underwrite another package so that that package becomes more attractive.
So how do they come up with a title then and say and show the court that they're in charge of it if the person holding the loan is not the holder of the title?
Exactly. But what the judge said to Deutsche Bank was, you've brought us here a list of several hundred assets in this pool that you're supposed to own. But where's the proof that you own them? Because these are just a list. So now Deutsche have got to go all the way back to J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan have got to find out what assets belong in what pool and break it all down because they hold that information internally. Deutsche Bank didn't own that. They only bought the securitized package, that single certificate with that average amount of nominal, average amount of loan, average amount of maturity, average amounts. There's no detail of all the individual loans of different lengths, different qualities. All that information is not there. Deutsche Bank trusted J.P. Morgan to give them a final package.
What is the solution for the banks to get redress on the fact that the holder of the resident of the property is no longer paying if they're not able to come up with a clear title to it? And in fact, to this day, the case is still – it hasn't been reopened by the bank because they really can't get their hands on the paperwork for some reason. It's very bizarre.
Well, the interesting thing is, you see, that Deutsche Bank now – because nobody expected these products to fail, and they have – what Deutsche Bank have had to do is go back to J.P. Morgan, and maybe J.P. Morgan's package that they sold to them contained like 400 or 500 mortgages, Darrell, and maybe 10% of them are failing. And it may be that the 14 people who were served to go to court were just 14 names picked at random, but there's no evidence to suggest that they're among the defaulters, for instance. Because it's this whole package, and what Deutsche Bank have done is said to J.P. Morgan, okay, give us the list of houses, and we'll start putting people in court and see how we get on. And rather than actually saying who's defaulted and who hasn't, because all they know is a proportion, 5%, 8%, 11% have defaulted and are not paying, but they don't know which ones because they've only got the single securitization package. The actual debts that are with J.P. Morgan still. What Deutsche Bank has said to J.P. Morgan is, can you put these guys in court for us? And J.P. Morgan is saying, why should we pay your legal expenses?
So there's a battle right now to see who's going to have to foot the bill for fighting for those assets, because basically J.P. Morgan owes Deutsche Bank the money, and the people living in those houses owes J.P. Morgan, but neither one of them are holding on to the title anymore.
Well, what J.P. Morgan is saying is that we sold you the right to put these people in court, whereas J.P. Morgan actually, of course, had the title. So there's a dispute going on between the legal teams representing the banks. The judge is turning around and saying, hey, you guys, you don't know if it's Monday, Wednesday or Friday. Come back to me when you know what you're talking about. And that's why I threw the case out, because it didn't make sense. Some of the people were in that court had never defaulted. But J.P. Morgan had passed the names on. Deutsche Bank don't know who to sue. They didn't originate the loans. They've bought them on a secondary market. They don't know who actually borrowed what, when, and at what rate. They don't know those individuals. They just got a weighted average of it all.
Well, now, this same problem is happening not just in the United States. We've got Canadian problems. We've got French defaults beginning. We have them in the U.K. We're starting to see a lot of pressure on people's wallets based on inflation. They have a different type of structure for their ARMs, for their adjustable rates. But at the same time, many of their subprime problems are surfacing. And it all goes back to this moral hazard question that many of the people who were getting loans for houses didn't technically qualify in a responsible banking structure, and yet they got the money anyway. So where do we go from here? I mean, I'm seeing cascading everywhere. Many of the real top-notch qualitative pundits who don't get out there and try to pump the lies, but just actually study this, like yourself, like many people who've worked this, they say this is worse than most people can even wrap their brain around. I'm wondering, Mohammed, since you've had about a week and a half to look at this again, is it worse than you think?
What we're waiting for is more and more honesty. I know how bad it is. What the general public is suffering from is a large amount of dishonesty on the part of the people in the know. And that's what the game that's going on at the moment, and why people who are coming to listen to the French Connection are finding out what's happening on the inside. We're leaking this information as other people we're hoping will leak what they know. We've already leaked the fact about Barclays. What's particularly interesting at the moment is there's a very important type of company which is known as a bond insurer. We were discussing this also. I mentioned this to you earlier on today, Darrell. About 8 or 9 of these companies in the United States, and one of them, the biggest, insures about $2.4 trillion worth of bonds. Now, the rating agencies like Moody's and Fitch, these are the people who turn around and S&P and say, they say, this bond is AAA rated or AA, in our opinion, based on our analysis of the company and the quality and whatever. They've got a set of criteria that they evaluate a bond on, and they put a rating on it. Now, one of the ways that you and I, we were floating a new car company, we were going to build our new type of car tomorrow, and we wanted to raise the money. We came up with this idea for a bond issue, and Moody's and Fitch and everybody came to us and said, well, you're only double B. And, of course, double B, as we know, and I'll explain to the ladies and gentlemen, that's below investment grade, so people won't want to buy it. What we could do is we could turn round to one of these big bond insuring companies and say, will you provide insurance to guarantee certain levels of payout on our bond? And if we get that insurance on our bond, an insured bond, again, this is what's known as an ABS, an asset-backed security. Here, the asset underwriting the security is now insurance. We've taken out insurance that says, hey, everybody, even if we go bust, this company over here will pay you 30% or 40% or whatever. And then that just tips us over into triple B. So these insurance, these bond insurance companies are very popular, Darren, and very big. And there was an announcement this week, I think it was Moody's. Moody's 1 month ago said that the number one bond issuer in the United States, there was no fear on the amount of capital they're holding, and they're still AAA rated. Moody's came out on the 5th of December, a couple of days ago, and said, actually, we were wrong. This company needs to hold a lot more capital than it currently has in order to maintain its AAA rating. Now, for cascading effect, you use the word cascade, and that's a marvelous choice of word, Darrell, because this is a AAA rated entity who's insuring squillions and zillions of dollars worth of bonds, $2.4 trillion, and they're leveraging their AAA rating to pull everybody else up from double B and single B or whatever they've got to take them up a notch or two. When the insurance company starts to fail, all the bonds that they are insuring are about to collapse. There's going to be a cascading effect. It's a nightmare. And what's happened is that number one, number two, and number four, that's three out of the top five there, ladies and gentlemen, have all been regraded this week. Because what they're saying is, these guys don't have enough money to bail out the subprime failures, not just in mortgages, as you pointed out, Darrell, but all the other types of subprime lending which have been going on. They're saying these guys haven't got the money to bail all this out. So unless they get more capital, we're going to have to downrate them. And as soon as they do that, every bond that they're insuring will slip.
So basically what we've got here is like saying it's a trust issue. Let's say, for example, I live in a neighborhood where I don't have anybody around me that I trust except one neighbor. And all of a sudden that neighbor shows himself to be untrustworthy. There's no place I can any longer turn for assistance. In other words, basically you look around your landscape, you see situations all around you, but there's no trust left. And they don't trust you, you don't trust them, and everybody's standing guard at their front door saying, we've all got problems, but we can't help each other because there's no trust between the different groups. This is a catastrophe because, you know as well as I do, our entire financial system is based on trust and confidence. And once you've taken the trust and confidence out of the equation, there's nothing, because everything requires people to be upfront with what they're doing and have confidence in their counterparty to do their due diligence. And when you find out the counterparty didn't do that, then you are no longer willing to step outside yourself and do anything with them. And basically what we've got now is banks and insurance companies and loan and credit card companies all over the place looking at each other saying, I don't trust you, you don't trust me. And the whole thing is starting to just cascade. And then you got these lame-os from the government just piling in taxpayer money to plug holes and not fix the problem. So where are we now? Let's go in. Is that a good assessment?
That's very accurate, Darrell. And in fact, the problem with these insurance companies, it's not – they actually haven't done anything wrong. It's just the magnitude of problem in the bond market is so great that the amount of money that they hold back in reserve to bail things out, the rating agencies are saying that's just not enough money to deal with this size of problem. Ordinarily, they're carrying enough cash in the bag to sort the problems out. But here they're being told, you can't underwrite all of this collapse. There's a level of failure here that you are not going to be able to pay out on. And that, as you say, is the trust point that everybody's turned around and said, well, we're relying on them to get our $30 back on the $100. You know, this $100 bond, this is insured for $30, and they're the guys insuring it. But they don't have enough money for this level of collapse. So this is not just cascade. I mean, this is a cascade that could very quickly become an avalanche. Another major news story this week, it was on the front of Reuters and Bloomberg and a lot of the papers, Darrell, was Freddie Mac, the big U.S. mortgage company, and doing an issue of shares, preference shares. And they're getting a few of the banks there to head up this new issue for them of $9 billion. Now, from a credit risk perspective, that gives us some very important intel on the Freddie Mac Corporation. It tells us two key things, Darrell. It tells us, firstly, for people to understand out there, Freddie Mac are legendary worldwide in the bond markets. The number of issues that they've got are vast. And what they've done since time, for more than two decades to my knowledge, when they want to restructure their finances internally, from an accounting perspective, they've got a set of coupons, they've got to pay out their interest payments to the current bondholders, and they've got some maturities and stuff going on. What they do is they do the famous restructuring. We hear this term restructuring. This is a company that never does it out of problem. It just does it from an accounting perspective. They'll buy back certain types of bonds that are with certain maturities. It's similar to the packaging idea we were discussing earlier. They look at the net effect of their entire portfolio at the moment, and they look at their short-term payment obligations. And historically, they were a very responsible company and very well managed. And what they would do is they'll just go to them. Anytime they need to pay short, they'll borrow long, effectively.
Paying short means that they have a short-term commitment on a certain requirement to be paid, and what they do is they go out into the long-term market, and they just adjust the way that they're going to receive money to pay off that short-term commitment. And basically what it does is it shifts their balance sheet out into the future so that the problems they're experiencing in the present are pushed forward and they don't have to deal with them immediately. But basically, that's not working for them. Now tell them why that isn't working anymore. This is a serious problem. Now, and they tried to make this into a big media thing, saying, "See, we're taking care of the problem. Freddie Mac is doing great. They're borrowing more money. They're going to lend us." Tell the people the reason why this is bad.
Well, of course, it was a big propaganda exercise, as you said, Darrell. It was put out there as a splash there that they were letting go of a load of unworkable debt and throwing out the dead wood and planting fresh seeds and reaping new harvests and all of that kind of jingoistic propaganda type stuff. But in reality, what that means from a credit perspective, the intel that we have on the inside as bankers when we're looking at this, we're saying, hold on a minute, for decades, literally 30, 40 years, Freddie Mac, when they need money, they just restructure. They go out, borrow, change, buy some issues in, sell some issues out. That's what they do, and they're the masters of it. They are the absolute masters of it. That's what they do. Now, they're going to the equity market and issuing shares in the company, $9 billion. That tells us that even they cannot restructure in the current environment. People are not prepared. Even if they buy back bonds, they will not take a new issue from Freddie Mac. So Freddie Mac can't go to the bond market, its natural watering hole. It can't go where it normally goes to get its money. It's having to go to the equity markets. So that's how tight the cash is out there. The other thing, Darrell, is obviously the number, $9 billion. That's how big their short-term commitments are in bonds which are close to maturity, where they're going to have to pay the $100 out and the interest payments. I would guess that's at least the next 12 months running costs that they need to service those things. And they are short $9 billion.
Now, see, if they end up going out to the equity market and getting people foolish enough to put money into this nightmarish company because it's going to be non-existent in a year from now, what they basically are saying to the investor is, if we go belly up and you're a stockholder, we don't have to repay you. There's no commitment on repayment of a stockholder.
Nope, absolutely none.
So basically they're looking for suckers to pony up the money for these people to, and it's a preferred issue. There's not even a list of people who bought the darn stuff. So was it sold internally to government printing presses? In other words, did the government shoot over to them $9 billion as an equity issue and they just put it on their books as an expansion in equity capital?
Well, they actually haven't got the cash yet, Daryl. They're making all this announcement. It's a bit like, you know, the iPhone. They're going out telling everybody these wonderful, really flash upmarket class of shares is going to be available. And look, everybody, you're buying into a company, the first company to rid itself of all of its problems. But in reality, what the whole exercise is telling us is this company's got problems that big that it's having to resort to this.
Well, there's an even bigger elephant in the room that nobody has discussed, and it came across on this guy named Jim Sinclair's website. It's Mindset, Jim Sinclair's Mindset. Citibank is bankrupt. He said it is a now what we're talking about in asset figures, the largest holder of assets of any bank in the United States. Citibank is insolvent, and he said, it's just a matter of time before the entire bank is belly up, completely gone. Now, that is a shocker beyond anything that anybody could have ever guessed at just a month ago. I mean, a month ago, if somebody told you the largest bank in the United States, probably one of the five largest banks in the world, is insolvent and going bankrupt, what would you have told them? You'd have said, ah, come on, it's going. And this guy says it is big, big problems. What do you say to that one, Mohammed?
Well, of course, Daryl, we've mentioned in a couple of our previous shows when we gave the idea of the way that their portfolios have blown up with this idea of the negative correlations, that there is a huge number of banks that are legally, from the legal definition, currently insolvent. There is,
yep,
a large number, and we are being lied to about how many and which ones, just to maintain confidence. It's not only Northern Rock in the UK. That's an absolute nonsense. To try and turn around and say that, which is a fairly small institution here, you know, to turn around and say, oh, Northern Rock's the only one that's a problem, that's absolute rubbish. There are many, many institutions which are having problems, and not just here, worldwide, absolutely worldwide, because there is something known in the financial markets as contagion. And that contagion can be anything from fear to a rating downgrade. What the word you used earlier, cascading, when it's something that's negatively that's cascading, we would call it contagion in the industry. And the contagion is massively widespread. And now they're just resorting to all sorts of lies and mischief in the media. Governments throwing money left, right, and center. Mr. Bush turning around and guaranteeing the rate of these ARM mortgages in the States. So
well, now let's talk about the knock-on effect of freezing loan rates in the marketplace. Those future packages will be left unsold. And, of course, you and I both know that if the government's going to underwrite the paper on that, that's basically a taxpayer bailout is what it is. But it's being bailed out with worthless money because the dollar in real value is about 50% overvalued as we speak, and it's at 75 or 6. I mean, I saw this man. He said, look forward to 50 on your dollar in the basket of currencies, and we're at 76 right now. I mean, that's a 50% drop in its value. I'm talking about maybe 35 or 40 for the value of the dollar. So what they're saying here is just lies, smoke and mirrors, and it's none of it's going to be effective in the long term.
Well, obviously, this when I used the analogy the other day of you know, Humpty, this is like Humpty Dumpty, you know, the type of collapse that we have here is a breakage which can't be put back together. It's like trying to glue a window or a mirror, glass mirror, back together. Once it's broken, you can't put it back together. And sadly, the attempts at repairing it, it's almost like sending Mr. Bean in to do the job. I mean, it's laughable. For anybody who understands the capital account economics in the world, they'll know that when all the banks lower their rates, which they're all doing, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England's just done it, the Fed's going to do it next Tuesday, when they all do it at the same time, it's a zero-sum game. All it's done is create propaganda for the media to say, oh, look, we're doing something over here. We're moving the pieces. We've got all the broken pieces of this mirror, and we're shuffling them around and we're reorganizing them into a mirror shape. You see, it's not dealing with the actual problem itself.
They're feeding into the system a whole lot of inflation. And it's actually, they're holding down these inflation rates by lying about the CPI and the PPI, which are the consumer price index and the producer price index. Basically, when you reduce interest rates in this kind of environment, what you're basically doing is devaluing your currency, is essentially what's happening.
Yep. The thing is that here in the UK, because everybody's so worried about this particular asset class, we're now using the base rate of national economies, the Federal Reserve rate in the United States, the base rate and the LIBOR rates here in the UK, they're being used to underwrite an asset class. As I mentioned to you earlier, Darrell, that's a bit like saying we're going to lower the Fed rate down to 4% to underwrite the cost of wheat. It's just so bizarre. We're going to do this to underwrite subprime asset classes of a particular type of bond, of all the different bonds that are out there. And we're going to hold the rest of the economy at 4%. We don't care what effect it has on the rest of the economy. All we want to do is save this bond here. They say all we want to do is save the price of wheat at the expense of everything else. This is just such outrageous conduct. It is so irresponsible on the part of these governments. I can't begin to explain the damage that it's going to do in so many places. These things are supposed to be adjusted according to a complex set of metrics which are all calculating out and saying, on net effect for our economy, as the government, we're going to make this following decision for the basis of everything, all the different numbers out there, all the different consequences out there. We're making the decision on this basis. Now, it's a single thing in the whole economy driving the rate. It's an absolute nonsense, Darrell.
But see, here's the interesting thing. When I'm taking a look at this from, you and I both have finance backgrounds. You've done it as a risk management specialist, and I've done it from looking at stock investing and other things, and of course there are a lot of listeners out there who know a great deal about these subjects as well. What I've had trouble wrapping my brain around is that once this nightmare has taken full root, and it already is on the verge of that now, and I've kind of put myself out on a limb here and said by the end of January into February, into March, that's going to be a 3-month period where you really see the full depth of this nightmare. What does it mean for individuals like you and I, the plebiscite, I call us, because we're the people who really we're not stakeholders in these crimes, and we haven't done any of this. We're just basically victims. And there's a billion, there's 6.2 billion victims out there waiting to be fleeced. What do we do about this? I mean, aside from some people are going to say we have to pray about it, and that might work for a lot of people. But I'm asking you right now, what kind of things can we do as individuals, Mohammed, to start ameliorating the potential disaster our families are going to face?
Well, I think praying certainly helps to relieve personal tensions, and it's quite useful from that perspective. But as much as we might pray and ask Almighty God to put the mirror back together, he's going to tell us, I think you need to make a new mirror, and you've got to sweep all this old stuff away, because you're not going to glue it back together. You're not going to be able to sellotape it back together. You're not going to be able to blue tack it back together. Nothing you can use will put it back together. The mathematics in the new paradigm, why does it seem that bad? Well, I'll explain it this way for people with a bit of a mathematic grasp. the type of formula used in all these packaging and these bonds and things like that are the same things that you find in, say, the Mandelbrot set in fractal mathematics. And you ask any mathematician, after you let one of those algorithms run for a period of time and you see maybe a nice pattern coming out, you ask him to either predict what the pattern's going to look like from that point or tell me what the formula was that originated this, he said that's impossible. It cannot be calculated mathematically. We're halfway down this process. Unless you know what the formula was at the beginning, you can't rerun it. And as for saying where it's going to go, it's utterly volatile. It's completely unpredictable. So it's the same kind of mathematics, non-linear mathematics, which is in the middle of all this money. And money itself is a set of numbers. And what we've done is we've let loose this monster, which is running all over the place with the banks all over the world with the numbers. And the banks can't control it. So this then brings us back to your question, Darrell. What do we do with a broken mirror? We sweep up the pieces, we put it in the bin, and we make a new one. There is no other way.
But we can't make it with the same players that got us into this mess in the first place. And we can't. Now I told you already, a decree alone could stop this with a single stroke of a pen. That is, if the political will was there, the Americans or the British or the French or one could say, we don't want to play anymore. We're out. And our banks don't do derivatives. We don't do any of that. And all debts, public and private, are null and void. And we're starting from scratch. And everybody who was owed money isn't going to get it. And everybody who owes money ain't going to pay it. And we need to start over.
That's a fantastic solution, Darrell. I 100% agree with it. And, if we actually start from scratch, then, a lot of people who were disadvantaged in this life would probably have an opportunity that they would never have had otherwise. They tell everybody that you've got an even starting place in this life, but a lot of people are born into the debt wage slavery trap. We would actually be freeing the whole world if we were to just say, let's just scrap all debts. Anybody who's owed money, forget it. We'll start again. And what you'll actually find, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is that the number of people that are owed money is extremely small. And the number of people that owe money is extremely big. So if we look at the moral hazard, which Darrell likes to raise, of how many people will be unhappy versus the number of people who will be happy with that kind of solution, we'll find that the number of people who are unhappy is a very small percentage, less than 1% probably, of the people who will be happy from a decision like that.
Well, because as you said, we can't repair the problem, and we have to reinvent ourselves. And many people are starting to see the idea that the reinvention, if they have their way, is going to take some draconian, violent, jackbooted police type of solutions, work camps and misery and the people think Les Miserables, the idea of poverty stricken young children sitting on the side of the road with dirty faces with their hand out hoping for a slice of bread or something, that is certainly in our future if their solution, which is keeping the status quo in some sort of balance here, that's what we're going to face, because this can't be fixed in present conditions. So the people who can least afford to handle this problem are going to be absolutely devastated by this. And even the middle class. This is a destruction of middle class financial stability. The only people who are going to win if they keep the status quo are the people who have bought hard assets.